A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny. This week, Chris Power returns to Little Atoms to talk about his debut novel, A Lonely Man. Chris Power is the author of Mothers, which was longlisted for the Rathbone Folio Prize and shortlisted for the Edgehill Short Story Prize. And Chris's debut novel, A Lonely Man, we're going to be talking about today. Chris, welcome back to Little Atoms.
Thanks very much for having me, Neil. It's good to be here.
First of all, tell us how you would describe this novel.
I would describe this novel as really about the relationship between two men and about what it means to tell someone else's story, I guess. But both men are writers. One's a ghostwriter who was working for an oligarch who has died, supposedly killed himself. But this writer, Patrick, believes he was murdered. And he's fled from the UK to Berlin, which is where he meets Robert, who's really the main character, although the focus sort of shifts between them throughout the novel. But Robert is an author who's sort of struggling to write a book that he's contracted to write. And Patrick's story sort of falls in his lap. And so he goes about kind of extracting it from him, albeit not in the most straightforward or honest manner. And he sort of doesn't really believe the story Patrick's telling. He believes that he worked for an oligarch and he believes that stuff, but he doesn't really believe that Patrick warrants being sort of hunted by the FSB or whoever these people might be that Patrick claims are pursuing him. And that sort of doubt is part of what powers the book, I suppose.
I want to talk about who perhaps the main character is a bit later on. As you said, it switches between the two, and there's a reason for that, which we'll sort of get on to. But the book is in the main told from the perspective of, it's a third person narration, but it's told from the perspective of Robert, so-called Robert Prowl, who is he's a writer, formerly somebody that worked in advertising before he was a writer, formerly of the borough of Hackney, now living in Berlin. He's a man that has a Swedish wife and a couple of young daughters and has written a critically acclaimed book of short stories. Tell us where this unlikely character comes from.
This fantastical creation. Yeah, I, as I can tell from your tone of voice, Neil, there is... your insinuating tone of voice. There is, I've certainly borrowed from my own biography to an extent with Robert. Although I should say that his short story collection won a small prize, whereas mine absolutely did not. But that's that's my right as I think that's called poetic license. Yeah, you know, I borrowed liberally from myself in some respects. Like, I think there are certain aspects of Robert that, who knows, maybe they are also from me, but that I would be less less happy about owning up to the identification of. But at the same time, I think that it doesn't really matter that you know that's anything to do with me. Like, I think I'd distinguish this from autofiction in the sense that the aspects of Robert's life that are close to mine, that's not really the point. And it wouldn't matter if you didn't know that my wife was Swedish or however many kids I had or anything like that. So in some ways it's playful. And in some ways, like, the name Robert Prowl was sort of a nod to to Roberto Bolaño, who I was thinking about quite a lot when I was writing this book, and he had Artur Belano was his alter ego. And sometimes he wrote about him in a way that was sort of close to autobiography, and in other ways, at other times, in a way that very much wasn't. So it was a sort of a nod to that. And in other ways, it was just practical, you know, because you use what's to hand as a writer, and it was useful to me to build a character that way, to take various strands or chunks from reality and then, you know, fill the gaps up in between with fiction.
And obviously, this is, as you said, this is one of the themes of the book, the idea of sort of using real life in fiction. And we'll talk about that in a bit. But I'm sort of fascinated by how it has a sort of wider resonance as well, in that you mention, or sorry, Robert, I say you.
There you go.
it's confusing. It's so confusing. Robert mentions in the narrative a short story that appears in his fictional work of short stories that sounds very much like a story from your collection, Mothers, which we talked about in some detail when we spoke about Mothers. And I, after reading the novel, I went back and read that story, but read it from the perspective that this is actually now Robert's story.
Well, that's first of all, you're a dream reader, Neil. That's just that's catnip for me. Yeah, it's difficult for me to sort of map it all back, or because I wasn't, it seems like a very knowing move to do that, but it wasn't quite as knowing, I don't think, when I actually did it. Like, I think some of these decisions are sort of made instinctively rather than calculatedly. But that said, yes, that story from Mothers is very autobiographical, or in fact it's a mixture of autobiography and fiction, but at the end there's a very autobiographical section where I sort of step outside the bounds of the story, and it's almost like an essay kind of appended to the end, where I talk about what I changed in the story, what was real, what was fictionalized, and why I did that. And so yes, that, I guess, that did speak to, you know, the strands that started to form in this book as I wrote it. Albeit those ideas about who can tell whose story and the distortions that are kind of inherent in fiction when you retell a quote unquote real story, they did sort of emerge along the way. They weren't necessarily there right from the start. They very much became what the book is about, but they weren't necessarily the subject of the book that I set out to write.
Let's talk a bit more about this idea of using, well, the sort of morality of using real life, real stories in fiction, which is obviously what happens in this story. And yeah, I mean, obviously, we've talked about the fact that, you know, this is not auto-fiction. The biographical details that you've used here for Robert are a bit of fun. They're incidental to the actual plot of the story. But it is certainly, auto-fiction is obviously something that's fashionable and is now almost seen as more, you know, authentic than just making something up. Obviously, there are conversations had about whether or not it's appropriate for somebody to write about another culture that they don't necessarily belong to. But even beyond that, writers are sort of exhorted to write about, you know, write what you know and all of that. But of course, along that comes, therefore, this line in the sand about whether or not it's ethical to write about real life and about other people, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a vexed question, and I think it's one that's present in all fiction, really. I mean, yeah, I think the question of cultural appropriation is a separate one. I mean, you can, they're related, but I think it's a separate one. I think the more widespread question that does affect all fiction or the majority of fiction is, you know, your borrowings from real life, whether that's a family situation or whether it's a dynamic between you and someone else, or whether it's actually, you know, an anecdote someone told you or an experience someone had. Or to talk about a specific example in the book, and really the sort of heart of that subject in the book, you know, something that you experience but that other people experience as well. There's a funeral described in the book, or actually a viewing. Robert goes back to London because an old friend of his has killed himself, and he goes back for this viewing. The friend is Irish, and he's going to be buried in Ireland, but his family are having this viewing at a funeral home in London before they take the body back to Ireland. And that was, you know, that has its basis in reality, you know, something I experienced and that I wanted to write about, but I felt very conscious of the fact that, you know, this was and is a traumatic event for, you know, for his family and for all sorts of other people who were there, but primarily the family. You know, when I was writing about it, they were the people who I felt, you know, I had to tell that I was writing about it. And it is a problematic question because I was writing about it from, let's say, the perspective of my sort of surrogate character. I mean, we've talked about the various differences and similarities between myself and Robert, but say for the perspective of, you know, from the perspective of this scene, his experiences were largely mine. So in that sense, I'm writing about something that I have some sort of ownership over. You know, I wasn't putting myself into the head of this guy's mother or father or whoever it might be, which adds another layer of sort of ethical complicatedness, I suppose.
That's also interesting, though, because Robert is a bit of an ass during this scene, it has to be said.
Yeah, he is. And there are, well, in a sort of feeble defence, I'll say there are, you know, there are elements of truth and elements of fiction. But again, that actually speaks directly to the issue, I think, or to the heart of the complexity of it, because along the course of writing that scene, you know, writing and rewriting many, many times over the 2.5 years I was writing this book, you know, the scene became its own thing. You work maybe off notes that you took at the time from a diary, and that's sort of close to reality, but you are writing from the perspective of a character, and there are other people there who don't exist, have been created for the novel. And along the way, you move away definitively and fundamentally from the real event. The event that becomes real for you, the author, is, you know, the one that's in the text. And over time, that takes on its own reality. Like, looking back now, it takes quite an effort of concentration to actually separate the real memory of that event, or the memory of that real event, from the fictional version that lives in this book, which I've spent so much time with. And, you know, it's like the fictional version has colonized or used up the real version to power itself, you know. And that's part of why I said it's a vexed question, because you're sort of taking something and changing it. You know, if people who were there read that scene, I imagine it'll be deeply strange, because there are things they'll absolutely recognize and there are things that they absolutely won't. You know, there's something about, probably even if I just tried to write it completely accurately, they probably have to a degree the same reaction, because everyone's got their own view on things and everyone experiences things slightly different. And no written record is ever a completely accurate record of an event. But in addition, the scene as it lived within the wider framework of the book, that became the most important thing to me, not an accurate remembrance of that event, which turns it into a different thing, and which basically means that you are, as the author, using it. And some people would see that as exploitation to a degree. And I think those sorts of questions and those sorts of relationships to truth and reality are present in all sorts of books and in all sorts of ways.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Chris Power, and we're talking about his debut novel, A Lonely Man. Chris, let's talk about the other main character, Patrick Unsworth. Tell us something about who he is and where he finds himself at the beginning of the novel.
So he's a ghostwriter. He's had a big commercial success writing an unconventional footballer's memoir, a huge footballer, and it's a sort of unusually sort of, I think, nuanced and kind of interesting supposed autobiography by this guy. And kind of off the back of that, an old friend of his who has had something of a sort of career in TV in Russia before coming back to the UK gets in touch with him because this guy's working for Sergei Vanyashin, this oligarch who's based in the UK, has fallen foul of Putin, had his various sort of assets frozen in Russia, including having a radio station taken away from him and a newspaper. And so Patrick works for this guy. This guy Vanyashin wants to write it sort of shifts. He's a bit mercurial, but he sort of wants a sort of memoir or a broadside against Putin. And he wants Patrick to write it. You know, he wants it to be a big book in the West to sort of get back at Putin. And so Patrick has this, I think, 2 year or so quite frustrating experience with Vanyashin, as he tells it, where he's basically put on retainer, but not really. He has a few meetings and it becomes apparent Vanyashin seems to have, you know, many things going on. And he's someone who's maybe not the most focused and puts lots of people on retainer in case he decides that that's what he wants to do next. And during the course of this, he seems to be told that Vanyashin has some dirt on Putin that's really going to be explosive. Vanyashin dies. Patrick is terrified and flees to Berlin to sort of work out his next move. He doesn't know where he's going to go. And at the start of the book, he meets Robert, or Robert meets him drunk in a bookstore in Berlin and sort of wants nothing more to do with him. And then later on, Robert sees Patrick getting beaten up outside another bar and goes to help him. And then Patrick insists on, you know, buying him dinner a few nights later to thank him. And that's kind of where their relationship begins.
The idea of ghostwriting, we talked in the first half about, you know, this idea of writing about real life in fiction and the ethics or, you know, of doing that. Ghostwriting is somewhat like a licensed version to do that. And what happens in the story with this footballer you mentioned, that Patrick basically writes this acclaimed autobiography for him, but at the same time sort of stitches him up. Because it's clearly not how the footballer or his family expected it to turn out.
I would say that was a sort of happy development later, I think. It became, once, not to sound too mystical about it, but once the book kind of told me what it was about, you know, that idea of what he was doing with this footballer, Albie Cooper, the fact that when Albie Cooper was giving those interviews and was given the book for approval, there's a suggestion from Patrick that maybe him and his people just didn't read it. But there's also the idea that maybe when you see something in one form, it can become very different when it's actually out in the public forum and people are suddenly talking about it and, you know, drawing their own conclusions about it. I'm experiencing that now, you know, with people's responses to the book. It always feels, even if it's stuff you kind of expected people to talk about, it suddenly feels different when it's output coming in rather than, you know, you imagining it or you thinking about it yourself. you know, Patrick being a ghostwriter really began in the practicality's sake, really, or as a good way in, because I wanted to, I'd read a lot about, you know, various deaths of Russians and people working with Russians, going back to Alexander Litvinenko and Boris Berezovsky, and, you know, the Skripal attempted assassination in Salisbury actually happened like the week I started writing this. But I'd read this long form piece called From Russia with Blood that Heidi Blake and a team of reporters wrote for BuzzFeed, published it in, I think, 2017. And it was a really fascinating report or investigation about like 14 deaths that happened on British soil of Russians and British like lawyers, fixers, money men, and numerous sort of issues with, you know, the investigation of these deaths, under-investigated, contaminated crime scenes, people not taking pictures of crime scenes, deaths that seemed suspicious being very quickly ruled as suicides and not investigated. And it was a, you know, I really was fascinated in writing something from within that world, but I didn't really want to write something from the perspective of someone who was complicit in that world. I think I really wanted someone who didn't really understand what was going on around them. Probably my deep and abiding love for ambiguity and uncertainty, because they seem to be how I experience life often. And so a ghostwriter really appealed to me as a way into that world, you know, someone who could legitimately be in that world but not know everything about it. You know, they're kind of asking questions and struggling to understand it themselves, rather than having all the answers and knowing that they're involved in a dodgy situation.
It's the perfect world for a novel of this sort, because, you know, I don't want to give away what happens, obviously, but for a lot of the book, Robert, and by extension us, the readers, are unsure whether or not, you know, Patrick is delusional and paranoid, or whether these things are really happening, in the same way that, you know, we're not sure whether these people committed suicide or were murdered, you know, by the Russian security services. And of course, that whole thing, you know, we don't know whether they interfered with elections or not, whether they're hacking things. That's exactly out of, I can remember, you know, talking to Peter Pomerantsev, the writer, about this. You know, this sort of confusion is exactly out of Putin's playbook, to sow the seeds of paranoia and discord in places. And it's like, did this thing happen? Did it not happen?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Russia is and has been, you know, for the last 20 years, a kind of, it's produced meta-narrative after meta-narrative. You know, it throws out all these, I should say, you know, this current administration, I'm not talking about Russia generally, but they traffic in confusion of stories. That's very much a policy of theirs, where it isn't your normal kind of like denial or single story that they're sticking to. They would throw out, you know, particularly under Surkov, who was Putin's old propaganda minister or minister of information, would throw out directly contradictory news stories about the same event. The idea being that you sort of flood the zone in American football terms. You just confuse the hell out of people by, which we've seen an extension of in the Trump administration learning, I think, from Putin, that, you know, if you can make people doubt truth, essentially, if everything's, you know, fake news, if you can plant doubt to the extent that you don't trust anything, then that puts you in a good position to exploit that. I think we saw that with Brexit as well. So I think, yeah, those questions feel very much of the moment. So I think everyone was familiar with the ideas that politicians lie and that you are sold narratives that aren't necessarily true. But the extremity of that, I think, has very much grown via Putin and, you know, people aping that. And also, of course, social media, where you sort of get this huge flattening of the media landscape. So stories jostle alongside one another, and one might be from, I don't know, the New York Times, and one might be from, oh, what's his name? The crazy right-wing guy, Alex.
Christ, I can't think of his name either. I've actually been on a radio show with him in the past.
Have you?
Yes.
Oh, my God. Yeah, probably best that you've blocked it.
Anyway,
that idea that you can't, or you can be reading like a news story in a respectable paper, and at the bottom you've still got those, you know, junk internet stories that are everywhere. Like, you won't believe what happened to Demi Moore's face or whatever it is. that just seems to thin out the fabric of what was previously known to be true or false. You know, those distinctions for everyone have got a lot more murky and more quagmire-like over the last few years.
Just to finish it off then, and then I'll get you to read a bit of the book for us if you would. When we first meet Robert, as we said, he's basically blocked. He's got this contract to write a novel, and he's really, really struggling to write the novel. And obviously Patrick coming along gives him the impetus to start it. And there are I said earlier on that, you know, there was a sort of debate as to which was the main character, because I love the way in which there are passages in the book that seem like they're being told from Patrick's perspective, but then it sort of emerges that these are actually sections from Robert's novel in progress. I wanted to talk about how writing the novel was for you, because obviously, as I said, you'd written a book of short stories. What was the change from writing that into writing this novel?
The change was, on one level, microscopic, in that I was just the same person struggling to find a good word to follow the previous word. I found, on a day-to-day basis, I found writing just as difficult as I always do. On another level, it was radically different because I was, you know, so doubtful about it for so long. I think with a short story, it might well take you years to finish it or to get it right or to make it good. But you know, relatively quickly, I mean, within a matter of weeks, whether there's something there, if there's something there worth pursuing, whether or not you actually succeed with it in the end. But with this novel, I just found it kind of really bedeviling, that the sense that the whole thing could collapse at any point. I mean, I think for the first year, pretty much, of writing it, I would just be struck every now and again, almost like I was, you know, walking along the street and then suddenly this, you know, ravine just opened in front of me, and just this sense of like, well, what if it collapses? Like, what if it's no good? What if it's just stupid? Was really present, like quite a lot. And I just would put it out of my mind when I was actually, you know, at the laptop typing for a couple of hours a day, that I was just writing and just concentrating on those problems. That was a sort of blessed relief. But those other times when I was away, when I was doing other stuff, or when I was just trying to relax or whatever, yeah, I would just have these yawning moments of doubt. And those persisted for, like I say, a very long time. I think actually looking at it now, it's not insignificant that everything that Robert doubts in the book are actually most of the elements that I had the most doubt about, because they were things that I, you know, hadn't written about before, and things that I, you know, really wanted to get right and to make convincing and to kind of calibrate things correctly. You know, the way in which Robert sort of doubts what might be going on and making that really tangible and believable to the reader was something I, yeah, worried a huge amount over. That's a moment where reality and the fiction were definitely close together.
To finish it off then, can I get you to read us a bit?
I'm going to read a couple of pages from when Robert has had dinner with Patrick and sort of learnt something about Russia and has been inspired to go and do a bit more research. Back at the apartment, he spent most of the day online, searching news stories and articles. Reading about the death of Sergei Vanyashin, a few details of the incident came back to him. As Patrick said, Vanyashin had been found hanging from an oak in the woods outside his Buckinghamshire estate nearly a year ago. Robert saw a photograph, a bare tree with a carpet of dark, dead leaves around it. There was a ribbon of red and white police tape running across the picture, twisting so the repeating words "police in a cordon" were upside down. Beyond the tape, a white canvas tent was pitched at one side of the tree. Vanyashin's body had been removed, but Robert assumed the branch he used was the lowest one, long and thick and maybe 3 meters above the ground. He used a belt, the news report said. Robert couldn't work out the logistics of it, especially given the shape Vanyashin was in around the time of his death, but perhaps he was more athletic than the short, stocky man in the newspaper pictures appeared to be. The obituaries described him as someone who came from nothing, a failed theatre director who discovered a talent for making deals in the chaotic period when 70 years of communism were swapped for instant free market capitalism. In 1987, he was driving a cab in Moscow. 10 years later, he had a property empire, one of Russia's biggest independent radio stations, and a small but apparently well-respected newspaper. Following link after link, the tabs on his browser growing thinner with each click, Robert toured the disordered and bloody landscape of Yeltsin and Putin's Russia. He read about how the oligarchs had written their own rules during Yeltsin's presidency, and how, when Putin came to power and demanded their loyalty, most gave it to him. Those who didn't were either imprisoned or exiled. Some were dead now, including Vanyashin. A few months before him, Boris Berezovsky was found, also hanged, in the bathroom of an Ascot mansion. A year earlier, another Russian, Alexander Perepolichny, Robert remembered Patrick mentioning the name, had collapsed while jogging, and there were numerous other whistleblowers and critics who seemed to have been made to pay for their actions. Alexander Litvinenko, poisoned with radioactive tea while his alleged murderer was given immunity to prosecution by being made a member of parliament. Several journalists, including Anna Politkovskaya, who was shot dead outside her apartment. The opposition leader, Alexei Navalny, threatened and repeatedly arrested. Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who was the richest man in Russia when he was thrown in prison a decade before. Looking at these half-familiar events in sequence, a connected narrative running from the end of the Soviet system to now, the wars in Chechnya, Putin's rise, the apartment block bombings, the sieges at the Moscow theatre and in Beslan, the dismantling of Yukos, Litvinenko's killing, the invasion of Georgia and the current conflict in Ukraine, Robert saw modern Russia as an extreme case of state masterminded corruption and violence. If Patrick's story about being on the run was a fantasy, he had chosen a credible enough villain.
So I've been talking to Chris Power. We've been talking about his new novel, A Lonely Man, which is out in the UK from Faber. Chris, thank you so much for taking the time to tell me about it.
It was a pleasure, Neil. Thanks so much for having me.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by me, Neil Denny, edited by Sky Redman, and was first broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. Little Atoms is supported by 89UP and hosted by Acast. If you enjoyed the show, please do subscribe, rate us on iTunes, and even tell a friend. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.